it's quite interesting to see that actually 1500 meter runners can actually be transformed to good marathon runners within quite short time. And that means that in events above 3 minutes, it's kind of the aerobic energy pathways that are really the main energetic determinants of performance.
Hello everyone, this is Vikas and you are listening to Run with FitPage. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Eivind Sandberg. I'm sorry if I did not get the name right, but I have practiced a lot, trust me. In the conversation today, we are speaking about the key determinants of endurance performance. When I started to know of Dr. Sandberg more, I started to research on the focus areas of his academic interests and started to see how much he has contributed in the area of sport performance and more specifically in the last 2 decades, the variables that he has researched on about the key determinants of sport performance, primarily endurance sport, have been fantastic. He's not only a great scientist, a great coach, but also a great athlete himself. You will see from the credentials online as well as from the show notes that he's quite a good long distance runner himself. He runs a 1 hour 11 minutes half marathon and 2:35, and he was talking about it very modestly that I'm not such a great marathon runner. In the conversation today, we'll go through the key determinants as I have alluded to a couple of times before and try to get into details of their definition, how they are impacted, and how should you make sense of these. I would strongly suggest for you to sit down with pen and paper, be patient, listen to the conversation, listen to these conversation and information again, and make sense of these for your own relevance. Please note that the point relevance is underlined here. It is important for you to see what's right for you, because your training stage, your training age, and your physiology may be different than that of everybody else. And that is why it's important to see where you stand today, where your baseline is, and then contextualize these information for your action. I think today's conversation will be so material that by the end of it, if you have grasped everything, you already have become a more informed runner. I strongly suggest this conversation in full to be listened to when you're not working out, not running, because you will need a pen and paper for sure. Let's welcome Dr. Sandberg to the show and know all about key determinants of endurance performance. Professor Sandberg, it's an absolute pleasure to have you with us to talk a lot about science and exercise science. And I think when I read of you through the book that I was reading in Inigo's book, the very first chapter, it just got me super interested and intrigued. And then I started to research more and more of your work. And as I continued to study more about you, I thought it would be an honor to have you with us today.
Thank you. Thank you. It's always always nice to discuss training and exercise. You know, I'm a scientist, but I'm also a practitioner. So I've been running and skiing my whole life, and I've been coaching athletes. From now I coach my small kids, and I've also been coaching on the Olympic champion. So it's something I'm really passionate about from many perspectives.
So I think we'll get into the conversation of discussing more on performance determinants for endurance sport in a bit. But before we get to that, I think it will be great to introduce our listeners of your academic research, your interest areas, and who you are, what all you focus on currently, where you have been academically, and I think that will work as a great pretext to get to the conversation.
Yeah, thank you. It's I originally grew up as an athlete, very interested in sport, and I was doing some running, athletics, and cross-country skiing that we do a lot of up here in Norway. And I did that and combined that with going to high school, where I can combine my studies with sport and have good coaches around me. Thereafter at the university, and I was really trying to get to the highest level in cross-country skiing. So I was close behind. In Norway, it's many good skiers, so it was really hard to get to the championships, but I was allowed to train with the best skiers in the world. And I was very introduced into best practice of endurance training, first in cross-country skiing. Thereafter, when I quit, I was asked to coach some of these athletes. I could go directly into and coach and work with some of the best coaches in the world in endurance sports, to work with some of the best athletes, and at the same time finalized my master's degree, my PhD, and that was also about endurance, determinants of endurance performance and endurance training in cross-country skiers. So, and then I was working combined in practice in the Olympic system and at the university, the Norwegian University of Science and Technology here in Norway, where I combined doing research mainly on endurance sports with also implementing this type of knowledge and working closely with practice in the Olympic system in Norway. So I did that for 13 years. And we also built up a research center that is called the Center for Elite Sports Research, where I'm the director at the moment. So I went from being a PhD student to being a professor in sports science. But the basic has always been to try to understand a little bit more about the determinants of performance in sport and how we can train to manipulate the most important performance determinants and subsequently improve performance. So I've been happy to supervise, I think now, 20 PhD students that has kind of worked on different sports. So we've gone from sport to sport, from to try to understand more of these factors, and also at the same time work closely with practice and see if we can implement this work into the real life. So for me, it's been a long journey in sport, and actually from August this year, I will still be maintain a small professor position, but my main work will actually be to be the director in the Norwegian high school system. So help upcoming athletes. So we have 14 different schools where we will, at the Norwegian top sport high schools, where we will focus even more on implementing scientific knowledge and best practice among our upcoming athletes. So I'm continuing this journey further.
Beautiful. Thank you so much for very rich experience and explanation of it. And that is why this conversation is a lot more relevant in today's perspective. As we were discussing backstage, that here in India, the record of marathon was made more than four decades ago. And since then, we have not been able to better it. We have not been able to make it better than 212. And we've been hoping and training very hard to make sure we get better than that. And I thought in today's conversation, what we could do is go into details of what are the performance determinants. Earlier, when I was a kid, I used to think if I run a lot and I keep running, I'll get to the Olympics. And I'll get my best. What I mean by this is what we grow up with, because when we know of ourselves and we are training, that time we do not know which family, which genes we should have been born to that would have been better versus not. And at times what also happens is I see that I work a lot harder maybe than someone else, but I see the other person starts to run better than me in a very short span of time. And these things keep leaving me curious as to why this happens. So does it mean that people are built differently from the very basic level as well, from a physiology point of view as well. And so I thought, can we start from the very basic and say, are there any performance determinants from gene perspective itself or from the very birth? Do you choose your parent or do you have to be born in a particular type of family to at least be eligible to become the world champion, for example?
Yeah, I think we need to be fair about that. We are we have our genetic predisposal. I'm not a genetic expert, but of course this is something we need to deal with in elite sport, that some athletes have very fast muscle fibers, but they are not so aerobically energetic. And you have others who have slower ones, but more endurable muscle fibers. You see the same with regards to the oxygen transport system, that I think most recent literature say that kind of to reach a high VO2 max, which is the maximal potential the body have to kind of transport and utilize oxygen, which is the sustainable energy that we need in endurance sports. Then around 50% is genetic to reach the very highest level, and then of course 50% is to optimize your training to utilize that potential. So I think we can, but it's kind of, you can say that our genes also decide our lot of how we think, our mental capacity. So when you discuss genetics, it's really hard, because also how we behave is influenced by genetics. But if you think more about kind of your physiological point of departure, and then what you can contribute to increase your endurance by behavior, by training, I think those who do research on it say around 50-50. But I think everyone can improve as long as you're healthy and doing smart training. You can improve your endurance a lot. But not everyone can be world champion in endurance sports. I think we just need to be fair about that. Kind of like in basketball or in high jump, you need to have a certain size to succeed. And that's the same in endurance sports.
Sure. No, point well taken, and that makes a lot of sense. Now that let's understand the genetics are say 50% and remainder can be other performance determinants. As a performance endurance performance enthusiast, how do I look at it? What are the core determinants of performance in endurance sport?
Yeah, you can say that if you wanted to be good in endurance sports, to endure, and then let's talk about events now above 3 minutes, and then it's quite interesting to see that actually 1500 meter runners can actually be transformed to good marathon runners within quite short time. And that means that in events above 3 minutes, it's kind of the aerobic energy pathways that are really the main energetic determinants of performance. So, and that's also the reason why you can actually be good from 3 minutes to 2 hours or 2.5 hours. Is the aerobic metabolic energy, what we also sometimes call the performance VO2, how much oxygen are you able to take up, transport and utilize during a competition? That is, of course, one important one. And the key factors that we can measure with regards to that is, of course, your VO2 max, which is kind of your roof. That's the highest amount of oxygen that the body is able to utilize during exercise such as running or cycling, and then it's not enough with a high VO2 max. You also need a high fractional utilization of that VO2 max to transform that into the total amount that of oxygen you can utilize during competition. And then it's depending on the distance. If you run 1500 meters, the VO2 kinetics, how that you can also quite quickly use VO2. can be important. In intermittent sports, the VO2 kinetics is even more beneficial. But for longer events, such as marathon, it's called lactate threshold, ventilatory threshold, critical power, anaerobic threshold. It has many names, but it's kind of the highest speed or power that you can sustain over longer times. So that's another important factor. And an additional factor that is really important in running is also the work economy or the gross mechanical efficiency. That means it's not enough to have lots of potential for aerobic energy. You also need to transform that energy into speed. So how efficient, how many percentage of your aerobic energy can you transform to speed? That is also a very important factor. And then of course, I think in longer endurance events, if you go short, the anaerobic metabolic energy will support a little bit. In marathon, that's a very, very tiny bit. It plays a minor role in marathon, a much larger role in, for example, a 1500 meter. And then there is also one factor that has come more up in the last years, and it's called fatigue resistance or resilience. It's also called durability, which is then how well you are able to maintain these factors throughout the race, which means that what you actually measure during the beginning of a marathon, then you have a certain VO2 max, a certain kind of threshold, and you have a certain economy. But when you then run for kilometers after kilometers throughout the marathon, the question is how well can you maintain this capacity at the end of your race? I think that's also a very important and additional factor, which is in marathon running very important.
I wanted to sum up of what I have understood so far that are the performance determinants, and I would request your understanding of telling me whether it's correct or not correct. So what I understood, the key performance determinants are, number one, the VO2 max. So one should have a high VO2 max. And of course, the VO2 max is something that almost everybody is aware of. The second thing is the fractional utilization, that is at higher threshold or BT, ventilatory threshold, etc., or critical power, whatever you call it, whether you can perform at that level for a long period of time. And third one, as we progressed, is we are talking about running economy. That is to be able to go from point A to point B in as efficient time as possible. And then the last one that you, I guess, also talked about is fatigue resistance in some ways. Do you have that strength to be able to carry over for 2.5-3 hours or whatever time of the race that you're going to run in? Is that a fair understanding that these could be the core?
I think these are really the core ones, and at least in marathon, that is the factors that you should improve to have a good marathon time. I think the anaerobic parts of it, that's more on shorter distances and intermittent sports. So I think we'll focus on these three main factors for marathon running today.
Right. Awesome. And I think why this is also a very good start is because this will help people understand each of these three a little more in detail, because when people think of at least the recreational runners, a number of them at least here, of people that I meet, that when their watch tells that they have higher VO2 max, they feel happier. When the watch doesn't tell that the VO2 max is higher, then they don't feel as happy. But then they need to look at all three variables at least to start with, or four, if not three, that they need to keep in mind. Now, are all of these trainable? Are all of these can be altered or not?
Yeah, at least we know that VO2 max is trainable up to a certain level. I think at some point you see a ceiling that it doesn't increase anymore. And I think in marathon running, it's the best marathon runners in the world probably has on average a lower VO2 max than, for example, a 5,000 meter runner, because the 5,000 meter runner, they basically run at VO2 max throughout the race, but the marathon is going a bit lower. But it needs to be high enough, and it's indeed trainable to a high level. Then the fractional utilization of VO2 max is indeed also well trainable, how you can increase your threshold. Of course, your threshold speed can increase due to a higher VO2 max, but it can also increase due to that you can work on a higher percentage of VO2 max. And that's what we see in marathon runners, that they are running very, very high, up to 90% of their VO2 max over very long times. So that's indeed trainable, and I think marathon running training is very good training to improve that factor. Then when we come to work economy, that's a discussion how trainable that is. We know that it's of course some genetic factors there as well. We've seen some studies where people very quickly increase their VO2 max, then sometimes the economy can even decrease a little bit at the same time. But what it seems to do is that if you have a limitation in your technique, or if you have a limitation in your physical capacity, then we often see that strengthening those weak links will improve your economy. We know, for example, the study by Andrew Jones that he showed kind of how Paula Radcliffe increased her work economy. She had extremely high VO2 max already at the age of 18, but her economy was increasing a lot. And I think that was due to more running kilometers she had when she increased her volume in her training. It seemed like it didn't influence her VO2 max, but it influenced her economy. And at the same time, she also did some explosive strength training that probably enabled her to have a higher level of strength. So when you start to be fatigued, the idea is that to be a little bit stronger enables you to maintain your economy and maybe even increase that. So I think that's a factor that you don't always see a change on group studies, but I think if you look at individual athletes and you target right training to the right athlete, then it's well trainable. And that's probably also why you say that some people train differently and they still kind of reach good performances. And then some people, they do the same as someone else who really get good effect, but they don't get the good effect. I think that might be that we are a little bit different. And then we need to kind of just tweak the training so that we are able to continue to develop our strengths, but at the same time, make sure that we don't have weak links that limits our economy or makes the risk for injuries and lack of continuity in training too high. So I think that's some of the beauty of training, to tweak the training in that way.
Got it. And these make a lot of sense. Before we move forward, what I was thinking is it could just actually be pretty good to go through each of these determinants and talk about its definition and how these have arrived for runners, so that they understand when they're looking at different data sets in their watches or on any analytics platform, etc., how do they make sense of these? Do you think it makes sense we start with VO2 max? What exactly it is, a little more in detail, and talk about how one achieves that?
VO2 max is the idea of VO2 max is that it should show the body's maximal potential to release energy aerobically. And aerobically means that you have oxygen available to break down, first of all, carbohydrates when you come up to a such level, glucose, the glucose breakdown. And then you have oxygen that you can bind up the byproducts and breathe that out as carbon dioxide and some water. And then you need sufficient oxygen. So you use oxygen as an indirect measure for the aerobic energy capacity. And then when you test that, you are normally using ramp tests or 3 to 5 minutes kind of test at a level where you can tax VO2 max. And you need to do it in an exercise mode where you are trained to kind of take out the full potential of the system. So that's the idea, to see where is your roof, what is the highest level. So you do a test where you try to find the highest level. And then, of course, we can discuss what are the limiting factors for this. And indeed, it's the oxygen transport system that is normally regarded as the main limiting factor, because the ability the heart has to pump out blood saturated with oxygen and deliver that to the muscles are kind of the main determinant. When we are healthy, our lungs are normally dimensioned to take up sufficient oxygen and saturate the blood, at least at normal altitudes. And then the question is if you're able to transport this to the muscles. And the muscles actually have an overcapacity to utilize oxygen. But again, it is not as simple as that. So there are also limitations in the muscles. There are also limitations, and if we are able to produce enough external power or speed to actually tax the system maximally. So it is an interaction of what you call central or peripheral factors. There's many names for this, but any limitation in the oxygen transport system, going from the lungs to the heart to the blood and to the muscle, and then transported back again as CO2. Any limitations there will limit your VO2 max. And then normally we say that the heart is the main limiting factor. If that was understandable.
Yeah, pretty straightforward. In fact, this was a little more detailed than I expected, and makes a lot of sense. And now it seems like VO2 max and fractional utilization, they go hand in hand, isn't it? So what would that be as part of that?
Yeah, it's. I think that that in order to increase the percentage, kind of percentage of VO2 max that you're able to utilize, it is that's more discussable how that is determined. But I think in running, if you're running at a pretty high level, it's of course related to fuel utilization, how effectively you're able to utilize your fueling, and it's also related to the muscles and how well the muscles are able to consume and utilize oxygen effectively, and also to kind of utilize that oxygen to bind up byproducts and release them. So I think that's if we say that VO2 max is a little bit more on the central, the heart limitations, the ability to run at a high percentage is more influenced by kind of the muscular factors. But this is a bit more a discussed area, I would say, because it's not so straightforward to do research on kind of what factors that are limiting it. Because what we do see that very high level runners, they have well developed capillaries around the muscle. They have very highly developed mitochondria, both regard to size and the number of mitochondria, which are kind of the power station or a network of power stations in the muscle cell, and also kind of the enzyme activity around it. But I think it's very hard to name one factor, but you see that the higher level you come to and the higher these thresholds are, that it's at least connected to higher physiological values on these factors on the muscular
Understood. Level. Understood. We'll come back to that in a bit as well when we talk about how to improve these. But from definition points, I think that makes a lot of sense. If I understood correctly, we are saying that the oxygen that's applied to muscles versus what's being utilized at the maximum level by these muscles is fractional utilization when we are talking about performance. Correct?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's correct.
Got it.
And it's also, if you run a marathon, we can also say that's why it's quite important to fuel correctly, so that you always have sufficient level of glucose, which is kind of you need that to sustain that high level over time, and to maintain a high fractional utilization of VO2max throughout the race. I think that's also a factor to be aware of.
Sure. And so are we saying that if you're fueling well during the race, that may help improve your fractional utilization because the glucose is getting transported and the energy utilization can be more efficient, isn't it?
Yeah. And of course, well-trained athletes, they are also able to very effectively use light fat, so then they can save a bit of their glucose to later. So they save their glycogen store. So glycogen is then the way we store carbohydrates in the muscles and in the liver, and then glucose is what we use in aerobic energy release. So you can store a bit more your glycogen if you are able to also utilize fat at high levels of exercise intensity. So I think that's a factor that is important. And then one thing is how high it is if you just test it at the beginning of a race. But if you're able to sustain that throughout the entire race is an important factor in the context of fueling.
Indeed. So now I think naturally that takes us to the point of work economy, that is that not only be able to utilize the energy efficiently, but the lesser energy that we utilize to go from point A to point B, the more we'll be able to conserve and possibly use it at a later stage. And so from that point, can we possibly define running economy or work economy? What does it mean for an athlete and how should they understand it?
Yeah, running economy is basically influenced by several factors. You can say you, for some reason, some people just have a higher or a better running economy. We don't really know why, but it's kind of like in our muscle cells, it's kind of... if you look at a single muscle contraction, I think it's around 30% of the energy that is released goes to kind of movement. And the 70% goes to kind of dissipate as heat. So we only 30% is kind of can be used for movement. And then that might differ a little bit across athletes. Some have a very high VO2max, a little bit lower economy, and others have a little bit lower VO2max, better economy. So it's kind of that differs a bit, probably due to kind of how effectively the muscles are or how many percentage of the energy release that actually goes to movement. And then the other factor is obviously that that other organs also need oxygen, and then the ability to kind of use oxygen in the working muscles and kind of reduce to organs that can save oxygen during exercise is a factor that might influence. But this is, I don't know how well this is trainable, but it's indeed factors that might influence your number if you measure efficiency or economy. And then of course it's your body composition, your anthropometry that might influence. If you have, I think there was some studies showing that if you have a little bit your lower leg, if that's lighter, thinner, smaller, you have a better pendulum when you run. But on the other hand, you need a good propulsion when you push off in running. So it's kind of balancing the anthropometry, your body composition might play a little bit of role, and then also your running technique. But I think if you look at studies who try to observe if one runner is more efficient than another one, it's very hard to observe. And it's also hard to kind of pinpoint one single factor that is important for economy with regards to technique. People run a little bit differently and they find their own styles. But indeed, technique might also play a role there. So there are several factors, and that's why I also said with training that you need to find out what are the strengths and what are the weaknesses of each single athlete. So you can, if you want to improve economy, you obviously need to run a lot to optimize the system in running. You probably obviously need to run quite a lot on marathon speed or close to marathon speed, so you can optimize it at the competition speed. And then there might be some limiting factors and weak links that you should tweak to try to lift it a little bit up. Yeah.
Got it. You know, and that's the question I was going to come to. That is how to improve the running economy, how to make it better. And you definitely talked about some of them, the very important ones already. For example, body mass. If you're lighter, it's considered that you may be having a better running economy if the technique is right, etc. But like what you said, also we have to keep the propulsion in mind with the higher weight versus lower weight. So what I wanted to also understand is there has been some research that conclusively talks about at least a couple of interventions using which you can improve your running economy. While we see that number of runners together, you will see they're running very differently or slightly differently to each other because the way they have been training, etc. And I guess we're not going to suggest them to do that, to make a lot of changes in their gaits, etc. But are there a couple of interventions, whether training-wise or technique-wise, is it to do with higher cadence? Is it to do with landing closer to the body, or is it to do with plyometrics interventions? What are some of these that may help in improving running economy?
I think again, you're back to there are some studies showing that plyometric training, some explosive weight training might play a role. But if you do it in specific movements in the legs that are specific to running. But then again, if you have an athlete that has overcapacity on that on beforehand, if, for example, if they come from a shorter distance up to marathon, they probably have a sufficient level of that. They have the speed, overspeed capacity. Then I don't think that would be a limiting factor. And then if you have athletes who are obviously running with a technique where they spend too much time braking, then I don't think you can tell them to stop braking, but you can probably tweak the training so that they, I know, for example, that running on a treadmill might be beneficial, at least combine treadmill running with running on asphalt. So because when you are on a treadmill, you set the speed, very many athletes are searching for a better technical solution to run easier at that given speed. Instead of an asphalt, then you can just reduce speed. So, for example, treadmill running might, for some athletes, be a tool that helps them to improve their technique and then again their economy. So it's finding this type of training methods that can be optimal for each individual athlete. And then obviously, if you're going to run a marathon and maintain a work economy, then we come to the resilience part. I think then sufficient volume is important, and also some specific sessions where you actually run quite close to marathon speed over longer time spans. So you kind of improve the economy at a more specific speed. I think that's training methods that are used by the best athletes and also quite effective on this factor.
Sure. Now, this one is very important, and I would request for you to wear a coach hat and not a scientist hat, and maybe guide our runners to talk about, should these interventions be closer to the races, or it should be early on in their training blocks when they are running closer to the race pace. Why I'm saying this is because one of the things I have seen that is the runners start to mimic the training paces or the potential race paces early on in the training. And I've seen one of the reasons they get injured is also that they're increasing the intensity and the duration of the intensity both together too early on. Yeah. So what would you suggest, at what stage should they include these?
I think it depends a little bit of your profile. If you have a marathon runner that is coming from 5,000 meters, 10,000 meters, they have enough speed, they have a high VO2 max already, and they come into this, and what they need is more volume, more specific marathon sessions. And if you add these specific marathon sessions, which is quite high, close to marathon speed over longer time spans, you obviously need to reduce the amount of kind of shorter intervals and those type of intensive sessions, but then they come in with sufficient speed and capacity so they can earlier on start their marathon specific training, would be my hypothesis. But if you come in with a marathon runner who is kind of are lacking a bit speed, it's kind of their potential to run fast on 5,000 and 10,000 is too low. They need to improve that first, and then so they can kind of have a little bit distance between their 5,000 meter speed and their marathon speed, because it might help them to lift their marathon. Then I would probably focus on that earlier on, because I think towards the marathon you need these specific sessions. I don't think you can avoid doing a good marathon preparation. You need some of the long runs, and you need some of the long runs at a speed quite close to marathon speed, and then there will be lack of space for training to be faster, and then you need to do that on beforehand. So I think when you start periodizing or building up a marathon season, you need to look at the athlete. What is the profile? And then you need to kind of go back and see how can we build this up so that when the marathon run comes, then the athlete is at their highest level.
Sure. That makes absolute sense. Now, just going back to the point on VO2 max, an improvement of VO2 max, because I think that could be one of the baselines that you, while you may not need to have the highest level of VO2 max, but you still need to have some degree of higher level of VO2 max if you want to be able to perform at a really top level. Then as people start the training block, do you think first they should be training to improve their VO2 max? Is it different than training for a marathon? Or they can just come with having some base mileage, and then during the training the VO2 max will improve in itself?
I would say that when you are at that level, I think the most important factor is to get continuity in your training, and in order to get continuity in your training, you shouldn't get injured. So to start with too high volume too fast, or to start with marathon specific sessions where you have long duration at high speed, it will probably kill your motivation a bit because it's so hard, and it will probably also get you injured. So I think the most important thing that they do is to start by gradually increasing volume. So you can start depending on what level you are at and what your training history is, but that you don't increase your training volume too much. So maybe you can build up, have a gradual increase in volume so that you are sure that you don't get injured. And then you first increase the number of sessions, then you increase a little bit the duration of the sessions, and then along those lines, having a good variation about between some interval sessions at higher intensity and some longer sessions. So I think that's, and then you can gradually increase the duration, both the number of intervals, the duration of the long runs, and the total volume. But don't do everything in the beginning. You can increase everything a little bit, so you get a gradual progression. But at some point, you need them to, when you come to a certain level, you need to decide, should I now increase volume or should I increase intensity? Because I think it's hard. If you do both, it will probably crash the system and you don't get the perfect adaptation out of it. So it's all about building slowly up the ability to run enough, to have enough volume, to have some sessions that are long enough so you can gradually train your body to be able to run an entire marathon. And then also to have sufficient speed capacity and VO2 max to do that on a high enough speed. If you run at four hours, I think you will get a high enough VO2 max to do that. It's not that. What will limit you is the ability to run and to actually keep on running, to be fatigue resistant, to actually do this throughout. If you come up to 3 hours, then you need a high enough VO2 max. So then at some point you should be sure that, do you have a fast enough 10 kilometer time, is what I would have said. You need to have a high enough 10 kilometer time. And then when that is at a high enough level to run sub 3, then you can start your more marathon specific training so that you are able to maintain a certain percentage of that speed over an entire marathon. So I think that's how I would have thought about training for more recreational athletes.
Got it. I think this was very important, what you said. That is, I think what I'm taking away from here is that they need to think of also where they are. And what we discussed so far in terms of improving running economy, VO2 max, fractional utilization, all of these are great. But all of these are not possibly applicable to all at all stages. And there will be a time when it may be applicable to a particular marathoner that can be sub 4 or sub 4:30, etc. But maybe at this stage, what's more important is first to be able to be on their feet for that long enough, to be fatigue resistant enough to be able to cover that distance. And once they can cover it, then try to cover it quicker.
Yeah. Another thing there is to have some variation. It's kind of like you should have at least 2 pairs of running shoes so you can vary between different running shoes. You should not only run on asphalt. Maybe if you have possibility to run on a treadmill once a week, on asphalt once a week, on some gravel roads or softer terrain. So you can give your body some variation. And then also try to be aware of if you have any, for example, lower legs issues or things that you can try to prevent injuries as long as when you progress your training volume. So some variation in especially the surface, and then also some variation in intensity. Don't do the same session every time. Try to have an interval session a week, a longer run every week, some shorter runs, so that you have some variation. Because I think if you want long-term development, I think it's smart to have variation in both with regards to intensity, with regards to how you organize your sessions and with regards to surface. It should all be specific enough, but variation within the running specific training. Then you assure continuity, and also that you target all the limiting factors and not only one of them. So you avoid kind of having weak links in your profile.
Fantastic. I know this may not be a question that you were expecting, and there may not be a direct answer to it as well. But do you think for amateur athletes, there is a basic weekly mileage threshold for a period of time they should reach before they start to go too far out in terms of very strong speed workouts, etc.?
Yeah, it also depends a bit. Now, here in Norway, many marathon runners are also skiing, for example. And then you can have a little bit lower running volume because you are skiing once or twice a week, and then you run in addition. There are probably other exercise most people use in other countries. But I think that for those who only run, I think you should probably try to... It depends on the level and how often you're able to train. But if you are at a certain level, to try to get up to 100 kilometers per week, if you aim to run sub 3, I think that would be smart. And then gradually start to add some sessions that 30 kilometers plus when you approach a marathon. I think then you will be prepared to run sub 3. But if you are sub 4, I think you can probably allow yourself to do less, maybe 50, 60 kilometers. But then make sure at least every 14 days to have a longer run done, so you can you start both mentally and physically to prepare yourself for the marathon, and also you learn how to drink and taking carbohydrates during these hours. I think that's also trainable. So these type of things should be included, I think, in your preparations.
Awesome. I think in today's discussion, the key takeaways for me have been understanding the fundamentals of performance determinants and try to contextualize in our own cases where we stand, how do we include these in our trainings, instead of only looking at these concepts principally and then try to implement blindly, because that will not work. And as you suggested, that no one plan fits all. We all are different and we are differently built. We react differently, etc. And that is why it's important for people to keep these in mind. I guess today, it already is significant amount of information for people to take in. And I would request any concluding thoughts for our listeners who may be looking to improve their timings. What else could they keep in mind? Is there anything else that's coming out from your research or anything else that you're seeing that they should be cognizant of?
I have two factors that I want to highlight that we are working quite extensively with because we think this really is important for performance. And the first thing I want to highlight is training quality. What is that? Now we have almost only talked about physiology and training volume, intensity, and these kind of loadable factors. But I think that there are two dimensions of training quality. One is the more holistic thing. If you want to increase your training volume, if you want to do all the factors that I've talked about today, you need to see your entire life. You need to be prepared for the sessions so that you are correctly fueled, that you have slept well, that you know what you're doing, and you don't just go out, you actually thought through it on beforehand. What am I going to do today? What is the aim of this session? What do I want to achieve? So that's clear before the session, and that you're actually physically prepared and mentally prepared for it. And then you go out and you do your session, and you are prepared to load your body and use the training principles that we have discussed before. Then afterwards, it's time to learn. How did the body respond to this? How do I react to this training? What can I learn from it? But also, what type of recovery do I need to get the subsequent adaptation? And if kind of you're kind of able to work in a circle here to continuously improve how you prepare for the session, the quality of the execution of the session. So you actually do what you're planned to do, which is the second dimension of training quality. Then this is a continuous learning circle where you actually, it's not only to do your training program, but tweaking the details of the training program, the preparations before the training, is something that you continuously develop. And you are on a learning journey where you learn more about yourself, your physiology, and your how your body responds to training every day. And then you can do these minor adaptations that will be what differentiate those who really get a good response from training from those who kind of don't progress that much. I think this is somehow a factor that is very underestimated. People think they can just get a training program and that's enough.
Yeah.
But it's not so easy.
Yeah.
So that's my key number one. Before I come to number two.
Please let's go ahead to number two.
Let's go to number two. And that's something we have worked quite a lot on lately, because we see that, of course, if you go to team sports, injury is kind of the most challenging aspect. But in endurance sports, it can be injuries, but it's also that you don't get the response that you want, and that you don't get the that people are underperforming. They go into some kind of underperformance syndrome or overtraining syndrome and these type of things. And we worked quite a lot with this, and that what we see very often is that you need a system to get people out of that. But then if you want to prevent it, you need to empower the athletes to take the right decisions. Because even though you have a training program, if you have the best coach in the world, if you as an athlete, if you're recreational or an elite level, if you don't understand the basics of training, if you don't understand how your body responds, if you look at all the technology that we get and you're not able to filter out the information, it will just be a confusing process. So to empower athletes to understand the basics of training, to build a good training system where you have some test sessions, some standardized training sessions that gives you answer, am I progressing, am I not? To have some systems of training diary or having a system of your training so you can learn from your training process. And also understand the other dimensions, kind of how does other factors in life influence my training, and if I have kind of a lot of other things to do, how do I then need to reduce my training? And to have this holistic performance development understanding that will help athletes on all levels to take out so much more of their full potential. So this is actually something we are working on establishing a business on at the moment. There is a Swiss woman, Sophie Herzog, that is now building up a company together with lots of experts to actually not only give people technology and all the external tools and training programs, but actually empower athletes to take ownership and wise decisions along that way. So I think that's something that we hope will really help a lot of athletes in the future, because this is what the best athletes in the world are doing. And all of us can learn from that.
Yeah, no, I think this one is so important, because just seeing data is of limited value. Making sense of that and getting right insights and actionable, timely, preventative, proactive insights are so much more important. Also, this is something that can solve the problems at scale, because not everyone has access to a coach who works with them on a regular basis, for example, and tracks for them. And also the first point that you said is even more important for recreational amateur athletes, because the work pressure, the work-related stressors are so much that it just, you know, if they undermine that and they're not keeping that in account, they may just not be improving, but rather going to a catastrophic outcome that they don't want, isn't it?
Yeah, because most of athletes I talk to, even on a high level, but especially recreationals, when I start looking into their training and I try to look at their training program, I don't find the answers for further improvements there. I might find it because they don't sleep enough. I might find it because they are having too much stressors outside their training. I might find it because they are not doing their training at the right intensity. Their quality is not correct. They are training too hard or too slow. So they are not, they are doing what they should do, but they are not doing it at the right way. Or it might be that every time they have a sore throat, they don't know if they should train or if they should rest. And then they go out and train. So instead of taking the wise decisions, okay, I need a couple of rest days now. And then it will go over after a couple of days. Then they have a sore throat for 2 months. And their season is shit because they trained with when they were sick. And it's these type of decisions that people are mainly doing the largest errors on. And there is no coach in the world that can take all these decisions for you. You need to be empowered yourself and to understand and trust your own body and take the right decisions every day. That's what you need to do. And that's what we want to empower. And that there is currently no technology that can take all these advices for you. There is currently no coach. Yeah. You need to empower every human to do that. Then you can take out your full potential.
Indeed, indeed. And it's very insightful because you are very right. There is no one who can do all of this for you. There are so many variables. It's just almost impossible to be able to do it by anyone. So, no, good luck on building this company. I'm very excited and seeing what is there to come in the near future. And I'll be tracking you and your progress.
Yeah, do that. And if people have any interest in contributing to the work of that company, they can send us an email and give us advices. We are willing to learn and listen.
Awesome. I'll put the coordinates in the show notes for people to refer to, and we personally will be very interested in understanding more as well.
Really, thank you for talking to me, for listening, and hopefully you got at least something out of it.
For sure, Professor Sandbach, it was an absolute pleasure speaking and going through this masterclass of the performance determinants, and I'm sure this will add a great value to our listeners. Thank you so much for being here today.
That was so informative, isn't it? I learned a lot. I'm sure you did too. And you could see from my enthusiasm how keenly I was listening to these information that Professor Sandbach was alluding to. Let's continue to grow. Let's continue to learn and continue to listen to Run with Fitpage. That is all for today. I'll meet with you guys next week again.